You're listening to a program produced in 2010 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. Now it is my great pleasure and honor to introduce our distinguished guest, Salman Rushdie, born in Bombay, India, who knew he wanted to be a writer at the age of five. His novel, Midnight's Children, won the Booker Prize, and his subsequent novels, including The Satanic Verses, The Ground Beneath Her Feet, and Shalimar the Clown, weave mythology, pop culture, religion, and politics from around the world to epic effect. In his enchanting new book, Luca and the Fire of Life, a young boy embarks on a quest to save his imperiled father. And initially, Luca dismisses the ever-burning fire of life as just a story. But his father's doppelganger rebukes him. He says, "Man is the storytelling animal. In stories are his identity, his meaning, and his lifeblood. Man alone burns with books." Please welcome a great storyteller and our distinguished guest, Sir Salman Rushdie. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. So I'm just going to read a little bit, and then we'll talk or something. It's a story, as was just being explained to you by Louise, about a boy whose father's life is in danger, and he decides he has to save him, and in order to do that, he has to do a number of impossible things. He has to step somehow into the world of magic, which his father has told him all his life exists just very close to our own, but like one step to the right. And if he can do that, which he can't, then he has to steal the most precious treasure of that world, which is the fire of life itself, which nobody ever has. And if he steals it, then he's got to bring it back, which is impossible. So, of course, that's what he sets out to do. And at the beginning of that quest, when he has actually somehow stumbled across this boundary from this world into the one beside it, he meets something very alarming, which is a figure that looks exactly like his father, but in fact is not his father, and in fact is something like an angel of death. So I'll read you that bit. "This Rashid Khalifa looked exactly like the famous Shah of Blah." Oh, I should say, by the way, that he has friends, Luca. They're animals, but they're more like companions than pets. One of them is a dog called Bear, and the other one is a bear called Dog. They're escaped circus animals, and they become his allies and companions on this journey. Anyway, yes. "This Rashid Khalifa looked exactly like the famous Shah of Blah. He was wearing his Panama hat and his vermilion bush shirt, and when he walked and talked, it became obvious that his voice was Rashid's voice, and the way he moved was an exact copy of the original too. But this Rashid Khalifa could be seen through, not clearly but murkily, as if he were half real and half a trick of the light. As the first whispers of dawn murmured in the sky above, the figure's transparency became even more obvious. Luca's head began to spin. Had something happened to his father? Was this see-through father are you some sort of ghost?" he asked in a weak voice. "You are certainly something peculiar and surprising, to say the very least." "Am I wearing a white sheet? Am I clanking chains? Do I look ghoulish to you?" demanded the Phantom dismissively. Am I scary? Okay, don't answer that. The truth is that there are no such things as ghosts or specters, and therefore I am not one. And may I point out that right now I am just as surprised as you. Bear's hair was standing on end. That's the dog. And dog, that's the bear, was shaking his head in a puzzled way as if he had just begun to remember something. Why are you so surprised, Luca said, asked, trying to sound confident. You're not the one who can see through me, after all. The see-through Rashid Khalifa came closer, and Luca had to force himself not to run away. I'm not here for you, he said. So it's unusual for you to have crossed over when you're in perfect health. And your dog and bear too, by the by. The whole thing is exceedingly irregular. The frontier is not supposed to be this easily ignored. What do you mean? Luca demanded. What frontier? Who are you here for? The moment he asked the last question, he knew the answer, and it drove the other questions out of his mind. Oh, he said. Oh. Then is my father? Not yet, said the see-through Rashid. But I'm the patient type. Go away, Luca said. You're not wanted around here, Mr. What is your name anyway? The see-through Rashid smiled a friendly smile that somehow was not entirely friendly. I, he began to explain in a kindly voice that somehow did not feel completely kind, I am your father's dad. Don't say that word, Luca shouted. The point I'm trying to make, if I may be allowed to continue, the Phantom insisted, is that everyone's dead. Don't say it, Luca yelled. Is different, the Phantom said. No two are alike. Each living being is an individual unlike all others. Their lives have unique and personal beginnings, personal and unique middles. And consequently, at the end, it follows that everyone has their own unique and personal dead. Don't, screamed Luca, and I am your father's. Or I will be soon enough. And at that time, you will no longer be able to see through me, because then I will be the real thing, and he, I'm sorry to say, will no longer be at all. Nobody's going to take my father away, Luca cried, not even you, Mr. Whatever your name is, with your scary tales. Nobody, said the see-through Rashid. Yes, you can call me that. That's who I am. Nobody is going to take your father away. That is exactly right. And I am the nobody in question. I am your, you might say, nobo daddy. That's nonsense, said Luca. No, no, the see-through Rashid corrected him. I'm afraid that nonsense is not involved. You will discover that I am a no-nonsense kind of guy. Luca sat down on the front step of the house and put his head in his hands. Nobo daddy. He understood what the see-through Rashid was telling him. As his father faded away, the Phantom Rashid would grow stronger, and in the end there would only be this nobo daddy and no father at all. But he was very sure of one thing. He was not ready to do without a father. He would never be ready for that. The certainty of this knowledge grew in him and gave him strength. There was only one thing for it, he told himself. This nobo daddy had to be stopped, and he had to think of a way to stop him. To be fair, said nobo daddy, and in a spirit of full disclosure, I should repeat that you have already achieved something extraordinary, by crossing the line, I mean. So perhaps you are capable of further extraordinary things. Maybe you are even capable of bringing about the thing you are even now dreaming up. Maybe, ha-ha, you will succeed in bringing about my destruction. An adversary. How enjoyable. How positively darling. I'm so excited. Luca looked up. What do you mean exactly, crossing the line? He asked. Here, where you are, is not there where you were, explained Nobo Daddy helpfully. This, all of this that you see, is not that which you saw before. This lane is not that lane. This house is not that house. And this daddy, as I have explained, is not that one. If the whole of your world took half a step to the right, then it would bump into this world. If it took half a step to the left, well, let's not go into that right now. Don't you see how much more brightly colored everything is here than it is back home? This, you see, I shouldn't even tell you, really. This is the world of magic. Luca remembered his stumble in the doorway and his brief but intense feeling of giddiness. Was that when he crossed the line? And had he stumbled to the right or to the left? It must have been the right, wasn't it? So this must be the right-hand path, must it not? But was that the best path for him? Shouldn't he, as a left-handed person, have stumbled to the left? He realized that he really had no idea what he was talking about. Why was he on any sort of path at all? And not just in the lane outside his house. Where might such a path lead? And should he even be thinking of going down it? Should he just think about getting away from this alarming Nobo Daddy and finding his way back to the safety of his bedroom? All this talk of magic was much too much for him. Of course, Luca knew all about the world of magic. He had grown up hearing about it from his father every day, and he had believed in it. He had even drawn maps and painted pictures of it. The torrent of words flowing into the lake of wisdom, the mountain of knowledge and the fire of life, all that stuff. But he hadn't believed in it in the way that he believed in dining tables or streets or stomach upsets. It hadn't been real in the way that love was real or unhappiness or fear. It was only real in the way that stories were real while you were reading them, or heat mirages before you got too close to them, or dreams while you were dreaming. Is this a dream then, he wondered. And the see-through Rashid, who called himself Nobo Daddy, nodded slowly in a thoughtful way. That would certainly explain the situation, he replied agreeably. Why not put it to the test? And that's what Luca has to do. I'll stop there. I just wanted to add one note before we have a chat, which is that the word, the name, Nobo Daddy, is not my invention. It's actually originally a coinage of William Blake. And in the Blake actually wrote a poem about called To Nobo Daddy. And in his case, Nobo Daddy is God. The poem is kind of a complaint against the absent father. You know, what kind of a father is this God who never shows up and never gives you any guidance and isn't any use? And Blake found that objectionable. as maybe many of us do. But in a slightly different way, being Blake. In this book, Nobo Daddy does not, he's not really a figure of God, but he is, if you like, a figure of death. So I just wanted to mention that I stole the name. And I'm given permission to have stolen the name because Joyce stole it too. He crops up in Finnegan's Wake, I think. You know, so if you're going to steal the good stuff. You know, anyway, this is so. Thank you.
Salman Rushdie, welcome to Los Angeles.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming here and coming to this city. You spent some time here, you said.
Yeah, I've been here quite a lot over the years, yeah. I mean, there even was a point when I had a little apartment in West Hollywood that would sneak in and out. Yeah. And was always alarmed by how early everybody went to bed.
That's right.
Yeah.
Depends on which part of West Hollywood you're talking about.
Well, you know, I remember being invited to dinner. Somebody called me up and said, come to dinner. Come at 6 o'clock. And I would say, really? And they would say, what, is that early? I would say, well, it's a little bit early. They'd say, okay, come at 6:30. You know, you'd find yourself going home for the night at 9 p.m.
Yes.
You know, whereas in New York, that's when you're going out for the night. You know, so it's different.
Yeah. Well, it's good to have you back here, and wonderful to be able to talk about this new book, Luca Thank and the you. Fire of Life. This, of course, is your second quote-unquote children's book. Yeah. In some ways, actually, it's a sequel to Haroon and the Sea of Stories. That book, of course, was written for your first son, mm-hmm. correct? And this is for your second.
Yeah.
And I was wondering, I mean, what made you want to revisit this world, besides the fact that I think your son demanded it?
Well, there's that, yeah. I mean, I didn't really have a choice. my younger son, Milan, read the first book. He read Haroon and the Sea of Stories when he was about, I guess, 9 or so. And immediately began a campaign for justice. I mean, what he didn't know was that really from almost the moment he was born, I had thought that probably I would at some point want to do again what I'd done before, just if only because the experience of writing Haroon and the Sea of Stories was a very pleasurable one. And the response from readers, young and old, had also been very pleasurable. And you know, if you've had so much fun doing something, you want to do it again. But I had always felt that the thing that made Haroon what it was that it was written, it was aimed at a specific person, you know? And so I wanted to have a specific person again, so I needed him to grow up a bit. But I was always planning to do it, but I allowed him to believe that he'd bludgeoned me into it.
And would you say that there is a distinct difference? I mean, there's Haroon and Luca are two different children. They have many years that separate them. In some ways, Luca was a surprise.
Surprise, so the child of his parents' old age. I mean, in that sense, it does correspond closely to my own life, because I was, well, within a few weeks of my son Milan being born, I turned 50, so it was later in life. And I think when that happens, when you have a child later in life, first of all, it's slightly easier. It is slightly easier the second time around, because you've noticed the children actually are quite good at staying alive. You know, if they don't break easily, you know, and that's a relief. It's and hopefully you have a little bit more money, so it's a little more comfortable also to look after them. But they're very different boys, my two sons, and I wanted the books to reflect their characters in some way. I mean, I remember actually after I finished writing the first book, it suddenly struck me that many of the books of this kind that I had most admired had been written for specific children. You know, that Lewis Carroll wrote the Alice books for a very particular Alice, Alice Liddell. And J.M. Barrie wrote Peter Pan because of his closeness to the Llewellyn Davis children, his friend's children. Christopher Robin Milne was the reason why Winnie the Pooh was written, and so on. And so I thought there's something interesting about that, to target specifically one person. You know, somehow those books had managed, by doing so, to achieve a kind of universality. And I thought, well, if I don't completely screw it up, maybe that'll work too.
But the books are not just about the two boys, are they? No. They're about the relationship between father and son, and the relationship is quite different. Haroon and Rashid Khalifa, his father, they go on the adventure together.
Yes.
Of course, Haroon is saving the father. Both these books is you have the son saving the father.
Yes.
But Luca's on his own.
Yeah.
And
Well, first of all, I have to say they're not Oedipal stories. The boys are not trying to kill their father.
No, on the contrary.
They're actually trying to rescue him. So, yeah, in that sense, they differ from the classics. I think, you know, there is a sense in which teenage boys believe their fathers to be useless and in need of help. You know? And so it comes out of that profound psychological truth. But yes, this time Luca is very much on his own. Although, is he or isn't he? Because he realizes early on in the story that this world of magic that he's stepped into is not just any kind of any old random magical world. It's in fact the world that his father created. It's as if he has stepped into his father's imagination in order to find in that imagination the thing that will save his father's life. But because he has heard all this from his father all his life, he feels as if his father is a companion and guide all the way through the journey. So he's alone, but he's not alone.
Right.
Because he's in a world that is familiar, which is his father's world. And even, you know, his companions, the bear called Dog, well, he has a big brother. Harun is now grown up and is a big boy and has various bearish qualities. You know, and so he has, and indeed he meets in the magic world a beautiful young girl, a princess, who has the same name as his mother, and who might in some way be a kind of reincarnation of his mother and who becomes his protector and helper. She's a girl she's the princess of a land called Art, which stands for over the top, in which people behave in very excessive and often bad-mannered ways. And she being the most excessive and bad-mannered of them all, although her official title is the Sultana of Art, she's actually known as the Insultana. Because of her gift for the insult. And so in a way, his parents are there, you know, transformed, transmuted. And he's not entirely alone, you know, I think. So, but it's very different from the structure of Harun in which the father and son go on the adventure together.
And I wonder, there's another difference, too, that I noticed between Harun and Luca, and that is that Harun, which, of course, was written immediately after the Khomeini fatwa, mm-hmm. Is a deeply, deeply political book.
Yeah.
You know, the evil character, of course, the Khatam Shud.
Yes.
He's referred to as the arch enemy of the story. He's the foe of speech.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if there was any kind of politicizing in Luca. Did you have that same kind of mindset? I mean, certainly we have the Alim, the bad
Alim.
Guys in this book, the Alim. And they certainly are not friends to the world of magic or to the story. But how do you see that? How do you see your politics in this book?
Well, I think the engine of the book is less political because it's more existential. The engine of the book is about life and death. It's about finding a way of talking to your children about death, about the fact that you're not immortal, and that you might have to. They might have to understand that there's going to be a point when they will not have a father, you know, and that's why, that's the frightening thing in the book. And I think that the character of Nobodaddy is actually quite a frightening character, because he embodies death, which is not something that children really want. I mean, my son's real plan for me is that I'm going to live forever, which, as it happens, is also my plan. So we agree. You know, I'm of the opinion that there's a famous line of Woody Allen's when he was asked by an interviewer whether it pleased him that he would live on in his work, his wonderful work, in his films. He said, no, he would prefer to live on in his apartment. And that's essentially my position as well.
Right.
But it is a way of talking about that, about the subject of death. After all, the quest is for the fire of life. You know. So in that sense, it's different from Harun, where you're right that the kind of central subject of Harun is more to do with politics and so on, but transformed into something more antic and enjoyable. But there is some political stuff here. And I think there's two things. One is you correctly identified the shadowy background evil figures who Luca doesn't confront till the end of the book, the Alim, who are the Time Lords.
Mm-hmm.
They're the lords of the past, the present, and the future. But they also are people who believe that knowledge is secret and belongs to them. and that the sharing of that knowledge is somehow improper. And they dislike the people, like storytellers, who try to disseminate that knowledge into the world. And Rashid himself freely says that those people are his enemies. You know? And of course, alim is a word which, if you know the languages of the region, you know, is related to ulama, which is a word used to refer to clergy,
yes, Islamic, the learned men
of Islam. But I wanted it not to be as specific as that. You know, I didn't want to narrow the focus. I wanted to talk in a broader sense about the very large numbers of powerful people in the world who believe that the thing to do with knowledge is to keep it away from the people. And that knowledge is power.
And that's ultimately what Luca is getting with this Fire of Life. I mean, the notion of stealing fire is an old one.
A very old
mythology. Yeah. And all of the great fire stealers show up in this book, from Prometheus to the coyote to Grandmother Spider. And the mythologies, regardless of whether you're talking about ancient Egypt or Greece or the Navajo in the United States, the idea of stealing fire is all about stealing knowledge, becoming like God, isn't it?
Yes. I mean, that's the story. That's really the story I'm telling, you know, because you're right that the story about the quest for fire and the theft of fire exists in every culture, every single culture of the world. And I found that when I was reading up around the book, that, you know, whether you're talking about Chinese mythology or Native American or Aztec or Greek or whatever, this may be one of the oldest stories that human beings have told themselves. I mean, if you had to think about probably one of the two oldest stories, the other one would be the story that invents the sky god. Mm. You know, but every single culture has a story about the sky god and has a story about the theft of fire. And so, yes, and of course, the theft of fire is about more than the literal meaning of fire. It also has to do with knowledge, with power, with passion, with creativity. Fire is all those things, you know? And so it's about, that's, if you want to look at the kind of grown-up bit of the novel, you know, I mean, it tries to look at that, yeah.
You know, I'm glad you brought up this idea of the grown-up bit of the novel, mm-hmm. because I wonder if after two of these books now, if you have figured out what exactly the boundary is between adult literature and children's literature. Is it language? Is it theme? Is there a boundary?
No, I don't think there is. I think it was Philip Pullman who said that you don't write down to children, you write up. Mm. You know, children are very, very demanding readers. They do not finish books they don't like. and in fact, they usually follow the advice of Dorothy Parker, you know, who said that this book should not be put down, it should be hurled across the room with great force.
Mm, yes, that's right.
And if you don't want to see your book describing a kind of arc across the room, you know, you have to make sure that you please your reader. So I think there's the form of the fable, the form and language that is used in the fable and folktale, you know, is such that once you've set that, you really don't have to think about who's reading it. You just write. Because the language is not, I mean, deliberately not complex. You know, the language of a fable is never complex. Although the things being said can be. And I think there are many books, from the Alice books onwards, where you don't even have to ask yourself if they're for adults or children. Mm. You know, the Alice books, there's much in them which I think is too good for children. You know, I mean, when we are asked to consider the difference between meaning what you say and saying what you mean, that's a very profound question, you know, which we are asked in the Alice books. When Humpty Dumpty says about language, he says, when I use a word, it means what I want it to mean, neither more nor less. He could be any politician on earth, you know? You know, so there are things in those books, which are, you know, Lewis Carroll was a philosopher and a mathematician and a logician and so on, and the books are the product of that too. So you know, on the one hand, you could say about this book, somebody rather kindly said it at Harvard yesterday, that it's an attempt to create a syncretic mythology. It's an attempt to say, here's the way in which all the world stories are actually the same story. Mm. And instead of talking about the clash of civilizations and all these fashionable things that we now talk about, let's talk about how much we have in common. Let's talk about how we have all told each other, ourselves, everywhere in the world, from time immemorial, we've told ourselves the same stories. We are the same species. There's only one of us, you know? And stories are the things that show that to us.
Well, I mean, I want to just stay on this for a moment here, because this is a fascinating topic, because what you're suggesting then is that you should not be aware of your audience, that, you know, in the Aristotelian sense, right, then this notion that you must define your audience, its composition. If that's true, then what makes The Wizard of Oz a children's book? Why is it a children's book? Why is Luca and the Fire of Life, quote unquote, a children's book? Well, and why isn't, if I may, why isn't Grimus a children's book? Well, why isn't Satanic Verses a children's
book? Of course, there is because of questions of language and form. That's
language.
Language and form. I mean, that's to say there's a complexity of language and form in both those novels of mine, which I think I would not encourage 13-year-old boys to attempt, you know? But there are, I think, many adult novels which are capable of crossing that boundary the other way. You know, I mean, this summer, just as a kind of experiment, I offered my 13-year-old son, Milan, Garcia Marquez's 100 Years of Solitude. And he just inhaled it. Mm. You know, it was like his eyes widened, mm-hmm. he fell into this world, and it was as if I had given him a treasure. You know, and once or twice he had to ask me what was this about, what was that about, but only once or twice. Otherwise, he simply sucked it up, and I suspect enjoyed it more than he enjoyed my book. But that's okay. You know, and I think there are other, I could see that you could offer some of the stories of Gogol, you know, the nose, the overcoat, to younger readers, and they would immediately understand them. I think you could offer them Kafka's Metamorphosis, you know, and they would understand it. The language of Kafka is not complicated, you know, and the imagery is fabulous, you know, and so I think this border is artificially drawn,
yeah,
you know, and that there are certain kinds of books, not all kinds of books, because I think books which are very complicated in language and very complex in form really don't belong in this borderland.
Well, of course, you're known for your language, your linguistic acrobatics, and this book, of course, has a lot of that in it. The sort of the use of allusions, which is so packed in your fiction, and I wonder if, in that regard, is that what you mean by language that's focused for a younger audience? For instance, I was looking at one particular page of Luca, in which I found in one page allusions to Alice in Wonderland, Doctor Who, Time Bandits, by the way, one of the best movies of all time.
Absolutely, I agree.
Back to the Future, Terminator, and Mark Twain.
Yes.
In two paragraphs.
In two paragraphs. Well, look, he's traveling at that point backwards up the river of time. He's going back towards the source of time, which is also the source of magic. And I thought he should probably meet other time travelers, you know? And so all those people are time travelers.
Right.
Doctor Who, the Terminator, the Time Bandits, the Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court, and so on. So they all crop up, you know? It seemed to be perfectly natural. Mm. If you were traveling in time, you would meet other time travelers. If you were traveling in space, you meet other space travelers. You know, you go to an airport, you meet all sorts of people. But if you're traveling in time, you meet this sort of people.
Yeah. Well, so, here's one set of allusions that have to be new for you.
Yes.
And that's the world of the video game, which plays a very large role.
Yeah.
Structurally, in Luca.
It does, yeah.
And it's quite important in Luca's life.
Yes.
There's this moment in which you describe Luca, who's just a video game wizard, as feeling more at home in this the virtual world of the video game. And you emphasize mm-hmm. that at home, mm. by which you mean what that truly means,
yeah, yeah.
than he does in his house.
Well, yes, and how true that is. If you've sat there and watched your children playing, you know, Red Dead Redemption, you know, they're lost in this world, which feels more real to them than the mundane world in which they do their homework.
I think most parents would complain about that. Yeah. You turn it into an entire book, an entire fantasy world. You say it's the most magical box of all.
Well, I say that from his point of view, you know, to be fair. And I think, well, on the one hand, I think I wanted to give him tools with which to handle the world in which he finds himself. And basically, he has two. One is the one we were talking about earlier, which is his knowledge of this world based on what he has learned from his father, and his knowledge of his own father, which is the same as the knowledge of the world. And the other is this knowledge of virtual reality. You know, and so he finds himself in a virtual reality, but he's familiar with the world of virtual reality, so he knows how to be in it. You know? And so he understands that if you jump on a mushroom, a life falls out of it, you know? And he understands, if you like, that thing he says at one point, what a relief it is that losing a life is not the same thing as dying.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So you have in the book two different ideas of life. You know, on the one hand, you have actual life, his father's life, which may be fading, and which can't be replaced, and which is of extreme value, and he goes on this whole journey in order to try and protect that life. On the other hand, in the virtual world, lives are everywhere.
Yeah.
You know, you find lives behind every bush, and you can spend them profligately, you know? And so I just wanted to contrast those two things. Mm-hmm. And again, yes, the book does kind of have some fun with the idea of video games, but it also does, I think, just suggest that our absorption in this new kind of virtual reality might be eroding our interest in a more traditional form of virtual reality, which is the story. And the book is, you know, is trying to, if there's an author's message in the book, it is to try and emphasize the value of story in human life, you know, and to hope that that does not get excessively eroded.
Would you go so far as to say that it may be dulling our imagination? Is it part of the world of magic, or is it, as Soraya, Luca's mother and the Insultana of mm-hmm. Ott says, another example of the way that magic is fading from the universe?
Yeah, well, I do think that a little bit, you know, because I just think it's, in the end, the games, because they're endlessly repetitive, And the amount of variation possible is, I mean, it's getting to be quite considerable, but it's still pretty limited. They are narrower, or narrowing, perhaps, of the imagination. So, yeah, I mean, there's a kind of for and against in the book. You know, and I mean, in a way, represented by Luca's parents, because his mother is not a big fan of this, and keeps pointing out to him that in the real world, there are no levels, there are only difficulties. And in the real world, you actually have to overcome those. You know, you don't have saving points in 900 lives.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So she's the boring one. The father, of course, is much more entertaining.
Yes. And also, he sees it. He sees, not only is he very proud of Luca's video game prowess, but he sees it as a form of storytelling, doesn't he? He himself is a storyteller. That's his trade.
Yeah, and that's what he responds to in these games. And there is a sense in which these games do follow, or some of them anyway, do follow the format of classical quest narrative. And as a result, for me, it's useful because it was a way of since I'm writing a quest narrative, mm-hmm. you know, to kind of to introduce into that a kind of much more, a very contemporary kind of metaphor structure, you know, and just to jazz it up, just to make it feel more of now. That was one of the things about telling a very old story, is you do have to find a way of making it not feel old.
Yes, and also to use the story as a vehicle for truth-telling.
Mm-hmm.
That's, I think, something that you take very seriously. You've said before that that fantasy is, in and of itself, a vehicle for truth.
Of course, all story is, you know, and I think one of the reasons why I don't like the phrase magic realism is that when people use it, they only hear the word magic.
Hmm.
They don't hear the word realism. And it seems to me that the point about the literature of the fantastic, or the literature which breaks the bounds of naturalism, and which includes elements that you could call surreal or fabulous or supernatural, is that it's just another way of telling a story. Mm. And the purpose of all story is to reveal or to explore human truth. Not reportorial truth, but the truth of what kind of people we are and how we are with each other and why we're like that and what makes us like that. You know, and I mean, that's true of other art forms too. I mean, if you go to the Museum of Modern Art in New York and you look at Van Gogh's painting of A Starry Night, I mean, it's a terrific painting, but it doesn't look like A Starry Night. You know, if you were to go out in the sky and look up at A Starry Night, that's not what you'd see.
Mm-hmm.
And if you were to take a photograph of A Starry Night, it wouldn't look like that. And yet, we all agree that it's a great painting of A Starry Night, because it tells us another kind of truth about A Starry Night. And I think in the same way as a photograph and a painting of the same thing are two different ways of telling the truth about that thing, you know, reportorial accuracy, naturalistic fiction, and this other kind of surrealistic writing are like that. They're different ways of talking about the same thing, but the purpose of both is to tell the truth.
Well, then what happens then when you're tasked with actually having to tell the truth? And I bring this up because, of course, you're now working on your memoirs.
Yes.
And we are, today is the 175th birthday of the great Mark Twain.
Yes, it is. Famous liar.
Yes, the famous liar Mark Twain, who waited 100 years after his death to release his memoir, which is now at the top of the New York Times bestseller list. Wonderful work.
Smart move.
So this is what I was going to ask you. So, you know, he didn't say why, and of course all the Twain scholars are talking about, you know, well, he didn't want to offend people. He wanted to say certain things about religion and politics that he thought, you know, he couldn't say, which I find completely absurd. I mean, was there anything that Mark Twain didn't say?
It does feel improbable, that, yeah.
But is it perhaps that there is this conception that when you're now tasked, when a writer of fantasy and someone who believes that fiction is a vehicle for truth-telling is now tasked with telling the truth, how does that happen? I mean, how have you been handling writing the narrative of your life? Is that possible?
I don't know, I have to come back and tell you in a couple of years. I'm just trying to do it now. In general, I'm very wary of talking about work in progress, but...
Understood.
There's a sense in which it's easier to write autobiographically because you know the story. You don't have to make up the plot, you know? And in this particular case, I certainly know the story that I want to tell. At a certain level, it's not different than writing a novel, because for the story to be interesting to readers, for it to have affect, you know, for it to emotionally touch people, the characters in the story have to be vivid and actual in the same way as characters in a novel have to be.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to create people on the page in a very similar way, really. The difference is that they're real people, including one of them being me. But they're people that I know and were involved. Was closely.
They're characters nonetheless.
They're characters nonetheless. Unless they become characters on the page, they have no interest.
That's right.
To the reader. So in the end, you have to start from the starting point of the truth, the truth that I know of things that happened and the people who were involved with those things. But then you have to create those people. So actually, it's not that different a job. But there, you're right that the question that arises all the time is a question of revelation, of disclosure. Because it's not, after all, only my private life, you know, that's involved. It's mm-hmm. other people's private lives who might dislike the idea of me lifting the curtain on that, on those lives. And so there is a judgment that you have to make almost in every paragraph about that. And my feeling, I don't know, you have to come up with a kind of plan for that. And my view is that if it's something that is necessary to enable me to tell the story I need to tell, then I have to say it. You know, but if it's not necessary, we all know very juicy stuff about the people who are close to us. And some of that stuff is actually almost irresistible to tell.
Mm-hmm.
but if it doesn't advance the story I have to tell, then it strikes me that it's maybe improper to use it. You know, so that's essentially the kind of measuring the yardstick I'm using, which is if it advances the story, then it's in, and if it doesn't really advance the story, or if it doesn't really give you a sense of who the person is, I mean, that's the other mm-hmm. thing. As I say, in order to create a character, you do have to create them in the round, and you can't create them only hagiographically. You know, you have to create them as real people, which includes me. I mean, that's warts and all. You know. What you can't do is make yourself out to be really fabulous, you know? and you know, fault-free. And everybody else was somehow oddly mistaken.
Mm-hmm.
mm-hmm. Now it can be told. You know, I was right, everybody else was wrong.
Right.
You know, that would be one way of writing it, but not in my view, a good way.
Well, I don't want to get too deeply involved in the work itself, of course, but I am curious about this because I teach nonfiction and I teach memoir writing, and I always tell my students that you're not writing about yourself. Mm. You're writing about a self called Reza Aslan or mm-hmm. Salman Rushdie, and that person is different than the real Salman Rushdie. As you're doing this for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
Are you discovering something different about the Salman Rushdie that you're writing
about?
Yes,
but I'm not going to tell you anything about it.
Very good.
No, I'm just going to write the damn book. You know?
Very good. that's exactly how a writer should answer.
Right, thanks.
What I'd like to do is begin to start inviting people to take part in this conversation. There's a microphone on that corner, and there's a microphone on that corner. Now, you know how this works. I point at you, and you ask a question, and that's all you do. And the shorter your question is, the more time we get to hear from our distinguished guest. So please line up at the two mics, and I believe, I can't see very well, but it seems like there's
at least... Can we have the house lights up a bit, so we can see people?
Ah, great.
Oh, yeah,
okay, so it looks like we've got someone at that mic right there, so please.
Hi, thank you so much for coming.
Is that microphone on?
You have to speak right into it.
There we go.
Hi, thank you so much for coming. I had a question actually for Reza, and...
Oh, good.
Sure. And though I'd love to hear Salman's comments on it as well. As an expert on Islam, can you clarify if there is a penalty for apostasy in Islam? And, I mean, since this is such an important thing in Salman's life, thanks.
Well, I mean, I'll tell you as a Quranic scholar, no, there is nothing in the Quran that is a penalty for apostasy, but I guess this is the entryway to a discussion that I kind of was hoping we wouldn't have to have. Yeah. I know you were hoping we wouldn't have to have it, but...
All I can say is I remember very soon after the moment which I think of as the moment when the excrement hit the ventilation system. I got sent anonymously in the mail a T-shirt, which I liked a lot. I've lost it now, but I liked it a lot. It said, "Blasphemy is a victimless crime." And that's basically my position.
You know, one thing I'll just say very quickly about that is that, you know, you have been asked many times, I think, by many interviewers whether you were going to write about it, whether it was going to end up in your fiction, and you've always said no because it's true.
Yeah. I think the thing that happened is interesting because it happened.
Yeah.
It wouldn't be interesting if it was made up.
Well, then I'm looking forward to seeing what it looks like memoir.
It was as if a thing that certainly to me would have been unthinkable became thinkable. Mm. You know, the idea that the medievalist, murderous tyrant of the Middle East should decide to reach his hand across the world mm-hmm. and try and murder an artist in his own country who had committed no crime in that country. No. It seemed unthinkable. Mm. And yet it happened, and now we all think of it as thinkable.
Yeah.
And that's the nature of atrocity. It makes what was not imaginable become imaginable. You know, that's true of all atrocity. You know, and I think that's what happened. You know, and the reason it's interesting is because it's true. You know, if one made that up as a story, you'd think, yeah, well, you know, it's a little overdone. You know, since when did writers become that significant?
Yes, ma'am.
Hi, I'm a teacher of English literature and creative writing for elementary and high school students. And there's a lot of concerns that the students have. What should they do with their lives? Why should we write? Being that there are a lot of very present concerns, environmental concerns, political concerns in the world, students sometimes ask, well, what's the point of writing creatively? What's the point of knowing how to write a short story? How can you answer to that? How can you answer that? Why should we write?
Well, it's interesting that you say that because in Harun and the Sea of Stories, that's the question that the book tries to answer.
That's right.
You know, and it's the question that Harun, angry with his father, asks him and then immediately regrets asking him. He says, what's the use of stories that aren't even true? Which is sort of the question that you're asking, you know. And the answer is, Well, part of the answer is given in Luca and the Fire of Life, which is this moment when actually Nobodaddy, the death character, scolds Luca for saying something that something is only a story. You know? And he says, you of all people, the storyteller's son, you should know that things that nothing is only a story. And he says, man is the storytelling animal. Man alone is the storytelling animal. He then goes into a series of rhetorical questions. He says, do rats tell tales? Do porpoises have narrative purposes? Do elephants elephanticize? You know? And he says, no, they do not. You know, man alone burns with books. So this idea that story is something not just enjoyable that we happen to do, but is something very close to the nature of what we are as human beings, is one of the things I wanted to explore. You know, the way that Steven Pinker in his great book, The Language Instinct, suggests that the reason we acquire language so easily, this very difficult thing to acquire, is because it's in some way hardwired into the DNA. We have a language instinct. And I've begun to think quite seriously that we have a story instinct. That human beings need story. You know, when children are born, other than sustenance, one of the the things you want first is somebody should sing you a song and somebody should tell you a story. And I think if you look beyond that at the way in which human beings, the way in which we organize ourselves through stories. You know, families have family stories. Communities have community stories. Nations have national stories. And in the knowing of those stories comes the belonging. You know, when you know the stories of the family, you're a member of the family. And when children are born or people marry into a family, they're gradually told those stories, and it becomes part of, or it becomes at the heart of knowing that you are actually a part of that group. You know, so I think we have used human beings, we use stories as our way of being who we are. And at the larger level of so-called grand narratives, we live in stories. You know, nation is a story, history is a story, religion is a story. We live inside these colossal narratives, and our ability to reshape those narratives as time goes on and the world changes is what I would call a description of freedom. You know, if you live in a narrative which you can alter, then you live in a free society. If you live in a narrative that people try to prevent you from altering and try to dictate to you how that narrative should be read and interpreted, then you live in a tyranny. And so it's just always has seemed to me that the subject of story is something much more profound, about it, much more intrinsic to human nature than it's often understood as. So I would say that that's the use of stories, whether or not they're true.
Yeah, Nobo Daddy says, yes. Nobo Daddy tells Luca, man is a storytelling animal. In stories are his identity, his meaning, his lifeblood.
Yeah, I think this.
Mr. Rushdie, it's very nice to see you in person again after about 25 years when I saw you reading in Berkeley.
Oh, well, there you are. Where have you been all this time?
Indeed. You know, I am only just acquainting the book, like most of us right now, having read The Dust Jacket and so forth, and then hearing your reading from it. But I'm very struck by this personification of death and your very interesting exploration of that. And it called to mind a couple of things. One is the figure of Yama in Hindu mythology, which, yeah, as far as I know, you could sort of think of as the prototype of this personified figure of death who comes and snatches the life and does this kind of thing.
Yeah.
But the other is that I don't know if you happen to have read José Saramago's, I believe, latest novel.
Please finish.
It reminds me tremendously of this personified figure of death as well. I was just curious if that was an influence.
Well, I mean, I like Saramago's fiction a great deal. I haven't read that book that you mentioned, but I think Saramago is a wonderful user of fantasy to make concrete the abstract. You know, and I think he does it brilliantly in many books. Yama, of course, the god of death, certainly in Hindu mythology, I suppose I was thinking a little bit of great Ingmar Bergman movie, The Seventh Seal, when Max von Sydow plays chess against death. I mean, I'm not the first person to make death a character in a story. Mm. It's just that I wanted this particular death to be rather specific.
Personal.
And personal, and to look like the person it's killing. And to be a trickster, because death is unreliable, not to be trusted. And so for Luca, it's difficult, this figure of death, because it looks and sounds and behaves so exactly like his father. It's very easy for him to be seduced into believing that this figure is fatherly, you know, and that is to be relied upon. And he makes that mistake at certain points in the book, you know. And gradually, as the book goes on, he has to tell himself, "Stop it! You can't think of this. This is not your father. This is actually the enemy of your father." you know, and it's not a good person, it's a bad person. But when the bad person sounds, acts, behaves exactly like the person that you love, it's confusing. And so I wanted that that double-sidedness to be there in this portrait of death. But yeah, of course, lots of people have done it before. Lots of people have done it before. Nothing is new, you know. Only the how is new, if you're lucky.
Yes, sir.
So I was just wondering whether you look at retribution and its connection to power in your stories as a way of sort of defanging the, you know, cruelty out there and some of the stuff that you've had to deal with, really.
No, I mean, retribution, I think I have almost no interest in it. You know, and I mean, you're asking about the memoir, but more generally about my writing. I really thought very early on, after the attack on my work, that the thing I didn't want to do was to write revenge books, which would have been, believe me, easy to write.
Can I just, I mean, was not Haroon in some ways a little bit of that revenge? It must have had some satisfaction to see Khatam Shud, you know...
Bite the dust,
yes.
Yes, but the Ayatollah Khomeini had already bitten the dust.
Yes.
You know, please remember that one of us is dead. You know what they say about the pen being mightier than the sword. You know, do not mess with novelists.
Yes.
So, yes, of course, I mean, the point is that book is it was an attempt to make sense of at one level, it was an attempt to make sense of what had happened in my life, which also had happened in my son's life, of course.
Of course.
You know, and I mean, he was 9 at that moment when it began. So he had to grow up through that, you know, from 9 to 19. It's an extraordinary phase of a young person's life to have to deal with material as dark as that. Mm-hmm. If you like. But so yes, of course, the book was an attempt to do that. But I think, in general, I'm not interested in retribution. It's a low-grade activity, and it also makes you the creature of the thing that you're trying to break away from.
How so?
Well, if all you do is define yourself against it, then you belong to it, you know. And I mean, for me, it was very important just to try and go on being the person, the thinker, and the artist that I'd always tried to be. And I mean, I hope that somebody who knew nothing about my autobiography, you know, and just read my work, would see that it was seamless. You know, I don't think that there's a colossal rupture in 1989. You know, I think that the work done before and after that time belongs to the same continuity of work. You know, and anyway, that's what I tried to make it.
Mm. Yes, sir. Is WikiLeaks a storytelling organization deserving of the same free speech protections as a newspaper, a political campaign, or a book publisher, or is it something else? Well, now this is, I think, a very good question.
Yes.
Because you are a champion of free speech. Mm. You believe in the unconditional power of free speech. There's something that Haroon says, where he says, power of speech is the greatest power of all. Surely it must be exercised to the full.
Yes, yes. But this, of course, is not exactly speech. This is revealing other people's speech. And I have a sort of argument with myself about it. There's a bit of me that is kind of delighted by the revelation of the immense hypocrisy of Arab governments. Mm. You know? I mean, I think the people who come out really badly in this are the Arab governments, all of whom were begging the United States to attack Iran. And you know very well that if the United States had attacked Iran, all those governments would have condemned it immediately, you know? So the total double standard, which is what we call diplomacy, of the difference between public behavior and private behavior.
Well, let me ask a larger question.
What I can't answer, and I haven't studied these documents in detail, is the argument made that it will endanger lives. That I know from my little contact with the secret world how important it is to protect witnesses. And if you have sources that are giving you useful information, source protection is the most important thing there is, because if you betray the source is killed. You know, he's not just slapped on the wrist. So you can endanger people's lives by making public material which is never supposed to be made public. You can make it much more difficult for this country to go about the business of information gathering. Because if people realize that this is a country which is so goddamn useless at keeping secrets, why would you tell them a secret? Mm-hmm. You know, if it's going to be in the newspaper the next day. So it may be that information that this country might need in order to protect its own citizens will no longer be given privately to the organs that would normally receive it, mm-hmm. because these sources cannot trust that the material will remain confidential. I mean, yes, of course, it's a good thing that we should know how the world really works, you know. And I think there is an aspect of this which is very interesting, because it does show us how the world really works. You know, when people are not putting up a public facade, what's happening behind the public facade? It shows us that, and that's, of course, you know, engrossing. I do worry. You know, I actually spent 9 years of my life being quite closely involved with the British secret state. And I found out a lot of stuff. And actually, the most difficult thing about the book that I have to write is not to reveal material that will mm-hmm. endanger people who were working on my behalf, you know, and whose secrecy is absolutely essential. You know, and no, there's no state in the world that would believe that they could act entirely openly. You know, with nothing done by a back channel, nothing being done in private, no negotiation being carried out covertly. You know, the business of the world cannot be carried out like that. And so there is a danger here. You know, I don't know how great or small it is, because I don't know specifically the value or otherwise. A lot of these documents seem like gossip.
Yes.
A lot of these documents seem like one-sided conversations. And it's quite true often that in order to lure information out of a source, you will present yourself as having a certain point of view which may not be yours, but which you use in order to get somebody to tell you something. I mean, this is the ordinary business of intelligence gathering, you know, and to simply be given the cold, the raw data with very little attempt at context and deeper understanding. It just makes it very hard to understand exactly what has been done. But I do think that, you know, in general, I agree. I mean, I'm glad, as I say, that hypocrisy is unveiled. I'm worried that lives may be endangered.
The truth is that there's really nothing all that new in these documents. They do provide a really interesting window into the way international mm-hmm. relations works. But let's take it to another level here, and let's just talk about the freedom of expression, which, of course, you are a champion of.
Yep.
Can there be limits? Should there be limits to the freedom of expression?
Well, I think you have to make a damn good case for it. You know, I mean, I think that the rule has to be that expression is free. And if you want to limit that, you have to make a very good case for it.
What about expression that incites hatred or violence? You were, of course, very much against racial and religious.
Here's a very interesting thing. The British and American positions about this are different. If you talk about where you draw that line.
Very much so. Legally speaking.
In Britain, there's a thing called the Race Relations Act, which makes it illegal to make statements which are racist or racially inflammatory. And you can be prosecuted for those statements and sent to jail for them. And sometimes people have been. Now, the First Amendment takes a different view. You know, the First Amendment says that you have to protect speech. And that includes the protection of hate speech, you know, which is why the Ku Klux Klan is allowed to say it's what it has to say. And the argument for that is that unpleasant beliefs and ideas do not cease to exist by being banned. Mm-hmm. And in fact, in some way, they increase power in power by being made into taboo and driven underground. And it's better to have them out in the open, because when they're out in the open, they can be argued against and demolished and shown up for the for what they are. You know, so that's the American philosophy. And it's not the British one. The French are different again. They have privacy laws which are far in excess of anything that exists in England or America, which entitles people to have large parts of their lives kept in private and to be able to act against newspapers or whoever who would reveal that or expose what was supposed to be private. So these are all democracies. You know, these are all solid, functioning democracies. And yet they define the limits of freedom differently. You know, now, I mean, when I lived in England a long time, I was, in broadly speaking, in favor of the Race Relations Act. You know, I thought, yes, it's perfectly right. You should be able, if somebody says something which is clearly racially prejudiced and inflammatory of racial prejudice, it should be possible to prosecute them and jail them. I would have wished to see that happen.
What about inciting religious hatred?
Well, this is the thing. You see, I think that there's a difference here between people and ideas. I think that you absolutely ought to protect individuals from discrimination on the grounds of race or whatever. You can't protect their ideas. You know, if you believe, like Tom Cruise, that the world is flat, it should be possible for me to say that you're a moron. And sorry, Tom. Actually, not really, actually. But so what I'm making is that the point I'm making is that you cannot ring fence ideas, and by that I include within that I include all belief systems. If you say to me, I believe and assert the following things, and I don't agree with you, it should be possible for me to disagree with you as vehemently as I want to. If I think that what you're saying is nonsense, I should be able to say it's nonsense. And if what you're saying strikes me as being actually reprehensible in some way, I should be able to say that I really think that's an ugly idea, without being accused of being in some way bigoted or prejudiced. Because this is the open debate is the opposite of bigotry and prejudice. So I think you have to protect individuals but not protect their ideas. And that's how you create an environment in which we can have conversations. Because the moment you start saying that there are ideas that are off limits, you know, dialogue dies at that point. Yeah, that's what I think.
Very quickly, ma'am, if you don't mind.
You had spoken briefly about children's literature and how there is adult literature for children. What about children's literature for adults? And what does children's literature as an adult do for you as a writer and as an individual?
Mm. Well, sometimes I think that we've all got so stupid that we can only read children's books. And this may have to explain the popularity of number of children's books amongst grown-ups.
Sure. it's a booming market.
Booming
Everybody
market.
Wants to write a children's book.
Yes, the little boy with the mark on his head. What's he called? you've heard of him. He looks like, it struck me today that he looks like a cell phone charging. Just permanently. You know, he looks like an iPhone plugged into the socket.
Yeah.
Sad fate for a kid. I think there's a child in all of us, and I think there are. The question is always for me in the writing. For me, the pleasure comes when there is joy in the prose. No, I mean, I think the great thing about the Alice books is how beautifully written they are. You know, and how much absolute, just you could just take such pleasure in the sentences. And that pleasure is just as great, I think, maybe even greater if you're a grown-up reader than if you're a child. And I think that's true of a lot of the finest literature for younger readers, that the beauty of the prose and of the mind behind the prose, you know, is I think what makes it of value to adults as well. You know, and there are some children's books, I mean a lot these days actually, these series of, you know, Marshall Badgers and all kinds, like, you know, they're all about war, usually with animals in uniform.
Mm-hmm. Talking animals, yeah.
And the writing is usually of such poor quality. I mean, especially, God save us, Stephanie Meyer, you know, cannot write a grammatical sentence. You know, that I had a look at Twilight. I cannot say that I read it. That would be a process that I was not capable of. But if you open that book at random, on every single page that I opened it, there were sentences that were grammatically nonsensical. And I mean, she actually can't write.
Well, you really don't have to. You just have to put a vampire in your book.
That's the thing, you know. I mean, you know, she reminded me of, you know, the famous dictum of Groucho Marx, when he was told that this law is so simple it could be understood by a 4-year-old child. He said, "Get me a 4-year-old child, I can't make head or tail of it." And I think, you know, Stephanie Meyer, the most 4-year-old children could write better prose than Stephanie Meyer. And that, I find it shocking, because with much popular fiction, I understand why it's popular. Mm. You know, but if I read J.K. Rowling, I get it. You know, if I read Stieg Larsson, I can see why they're popular. You know, it's comprehensible. Why do people rush towards these books? I see. When the books are just actually functionally illiterate, I don't see.
Teenage girls in love. Yes. I'm afraid this is going to have to be our final question.
So I was going to ask you about WikiLeaks, but then since you covered that so well, I came up with another question.
WikiLeaks questions?
So I came up with another question, which Reza promptly asked you thereafter. So maybe I can just prompt you to speak on what I thought was the outrage of having Cat Stevens parading around on stage at the so-called rally to restore civility and sanity, and maybe where the line is when tolerance becomes tolerance of intolerance.
Well, I'm afraid, I was unpleasantly surprised when...
You called John, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. I just thought, you know, how does this happen? I mean, truthfully, he hasn't been Cat Stevens for a long time. You know, when I was a college student, I had a copy of Tea for the Tillerman, you know, and Catch Bullet 4, all those things. And, you know, he had a melodic gift. He wrote some beautiful songs, I think. But he hasn't been that person for a long time. You know, he's been Yusuf Islam, and now, of course, that the word Islam, he thinks, doesn't play that well. He's dropped that, and he's just become Yusuf, as if he was Madonna or Cher, you know, with a beard, you know? Imagine Cher with a beard, and you have Yusuf, you know? Horrifying. Anyway, there he was singing Peace Train, you know? And I thought that was... Well, I had a problem with it, so I did. I called John Stewart, and we had a series. We had three conversations, actually, and over a couple of days. And I think by the end of it, I don't want to speak for him, but I got the sense that he understood that there might have been a better candidate to put on his stage. You know, I mean, I don't know, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, fine, you know?
I'm going to say something that I probably shouldn't say, but I know for a fact that John had no idea
No.
About the whole thing.
No, that was quite clear.
Somebody had to actually tell him. Yeah. Apparently, he just, wasn't aware of what happened.
I think that's right. He just thought he was the guy who sang Peace Train.
Yeah.
You know?
I think that's exactly right.
And I thought, that's our team, I thought. But, you know, I thought, they've got Glenn Beck and we've got... Okay. That was disappointing.
Well, on that note, right. Sir Salman Rushdie, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for coming. Thank our sponsors, KPCC, KUSC, and LA Weekly. Thank you, Sir Salman Rushdie and Reza Aslan.
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, City National Bank, K&L Gates, KPMG, the Bujaki Foundation, Susan and David Rosenblum, Wallace Foundation, and Donna and Martin J. Wolfe. Media support provided by KPCC 83.9 FM and KUSC 91.5 FM. Additional support provided by the Council of the Library Foundation and individual Library Foundation members. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.